It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out.
Politics aside, being a woman is hard. When it comes to our ever-changing menstrual cycle, perimenopause, or menopause, we could use support, and that's where Happy Mammoth comes in. Remember that awful week before your period where you feel off and look in the mirror and don't recognize your reflection and you want to crawl out of your own skin? I don't. Estro Control by Happy Mammoth has made managing PMS symptoms so much easier. And for my friends who are going through menopause or perimenopause, or even if you've come out the other side and still feel like a wet sock on a busy highway, Hormone Harmony is a lifesaver. It's not just me saying this, it's become a phenomenon. Women can't stop talking about it on social media, and a bottle is sold every 24 seconds. The secret? Happy Mammoth uses only science-backed ingredients, including adaptogens, which help your body adapt to the stressors of hormonal changes. It's not just for menopause either. Any woman with hormonal imbalances can benefit. Imagine getting relief from hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, and poor sleep. And the best part, feeling like yourself again. With over 17,000 reviews, this isn't just hype. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code RAIN for 15% off.
True Crime Fest Northwest is just a few weeks away, and you can get your tickets now at truecrimefestnorthwest.com. What can you expect from the inaugural event? On Friday, August 30th, attendees can check out the Expo Hall before enjoying a kickoff presentation and self-defense training from Rose City Self-Defense. On Saturday, you'll have another chance to get swag from your favorite podcasters and true crime creators in the Expo Hall. Presentations on Saturday include, but are not limited to, Desiree Young, who is Kyron Horman's mother, United Justice Group, which is family members of victims of accused serial killer Jesse Calhoun, our friends Sisters in Survival, a.k.a. Tiffany Edens and Danielle Tudor, the National Center for Victims of Crime, authors Lindsay Wade and Rebecca Morris, and some of your favorite podcasts like PNW Haunts and Homicides, A Hateful Homicide, Somewhere in the Pines, Snake River Killer, and of course, Murder in the Rain, among others. And those are just some of the scheduled appearances. Saturday night will also be the time for the VIP party. Sunday, the festivities continue with presentations, a drag bingo raffle fundraiser, and a VIP brunch. So get to truecrimefestnorthwest.com, use code RAIN10 for 10% off, and get your tickets today. And vendors, there's still time to sign up for a table. Visit truecrimefestnorthwest.com and get your tickets now.
West, True Crime Fest Northwest, True Crime Fest Northwest.
True Crime Fest Northwest. True Crime Fest Northwest.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. It's a new month, so that means we've got a new update episode. And here to kick things off is one Miss Emily Rowney.
Now is the special time when we get to shout out some very special people in our lives, our Patreon supporters. Let's give a big welcome to two new members, Jenny M. from Blairstown, Iowa, and Steve S. from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, I've been there. Thank you so much for your support. If you want to hear your name on an episode, go to patreon.com/murderintherain to sign up at our $10 level, which comes with some pretty cool perks. We also have other levels with other cool perks. We appreciate all of our supporters at all levels. We couldn't do things like CrimeCon, True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival, or True Crime Fest Northwest without you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, we had the absolute delight of going to our second CrimeCon. We were part of Podcast Row, where we had the honor of mingling with other true crime podcasts and meeting some amazing listeners. Thank you to every single person who stopped by to say hi.
Thank you. That's just going to be my theme.
I like it. We have two more podcast festivals coming up, and there's still time to get tickets and meet your favorite podcast friends. We'll be in Denver, Colorado for the True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival, July 12th through 14th. This festival is great, and it's really centered on family advocates and survivors. We all get to come together and learn from each other and share experiences. Some of the other podcasts that will be there are Crime Weekly, Wine and Crime, Murder, She Told, and many, many others. We're also going to be having a session Sunday morning with good friends of Murder in the Rain, Daniel Tudor and Tiffany Edens, who were featured in our episodes Unprecedented and Sisters in Survival. You can get your tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and use the code RAIN15 at checkout to get 15% off your tickets.
Later this summer, we'll be at True Crime Fest Northwest in beautiful Portland, Oregon, August 30th through September 1st. Some of the other podcasts that will be there are Missing in the PNW, Pacific Northwest Haunts and Homicides, and A Hateful Homicide. There will also be some amazing authors like Rebecca Morris, who you heard from in our episodes Nightmare Year and Bless Our Anne, and former detective Lindsay Wade, who was featured in our episode Mud and Blood. You can get your tickets at truecrimefestnorthwest.com. And don't forget to use promo code RAIN10 at checkout for 10% off your tickets. Links to these events are in our show notes. Code RAIN10 for 90% on.
Our first story today goes out to our Seattle listeners as an FYI. Assistant Police Chief Tyrone Davis, who heads the SWAT team, among other things, has been put on a paid administrative leave. Chief of Police Adrian Diaz is currently dealing with 7 employee claims of hostile workplace and discrimination and a $5 million sexual discrimination lawsuit of his own, so this is not ideal for the department. SPD has not been transparent about the decision to place Davis on leave, but it appears it may be related to a complaint filed by the Community Police Commission. And hold on to your butts, because I've got an update on this update. Literally, as we were sitting down to record this, it was announced that Chief Adrian Diaz has been removed from his position. Mayor Bruce Harrell gave a news conference at 1 p.m. on May 29th announcing Diaz was, quote, stepping aside to work on special assignments. For now, the interim chief will be Susan Rohr, who has paused her retirement to do so. The mayor spoke highly of Diaz and even talked about crime statistics being lower under him, that they are really good friends. Crime is lower. Applications to be police officers have gone up 300%. The mayor then moved on to talk about cultural issues and how the department is perceived. Allegations of discrimination and harassment have led to an independent investigation. So both the mayor and the former chief and the new chief spoke at this press conference. They said, you know, we need to put the needs of the city and the police department first. The mayor really talked a lot about a culture change that needs to happen, which will happen if Diaz steps aside. He can't lead the city while addressing all of these allegations. The new chief was from the King County Sheriff. She was on Obama's task force on 21st century policing and modern policing and public safety strategies. So she, along with the mayor, will be immediately searching for a new permanent chief. And the number one thing, again, is a culture change, which the mayor knows is difficult. So he's actually said he's going to be looking outside of the department for a new chief to change the culture from the inside. They'll find a new chief that they hope will make everyone proud of the SPD. Chief Worthen said that now is a turbulent time. She wants to comfort everyone, saying that things are going to get better with her coming in. So tomorrow she's going to start by having conversations with members of the SPD, and she wants to know how to improve things. And she expects brutal honesty to be able to make the changes she needs to deliver good policing. From there, she's then going to talk to community members so that she can improve that side of things as well, how the SPD is perceived and what changes can be made to make everyone feel safe on both sides. So obviously more is going to be coming out about all of this, but for now, I just want to let you know that there are a lot of changes and chaos going on in the upper levels of the Seattle Police Department.
It's pretty worrying that they're so desperate to increase their staff numbers and also are hiring at a really rapid rate. I feel like that's going to affect the quality of the employee and their work.
Yeah, so I'm not
sure if they'll take.
I'm not sure how quick. I mean, he made it clear that she's not in it for the long haul and they're going to look for people quickly, but he didn't give a timeline, you know, like within 3 weeks we'll have a new chief. So I do hope that they will end up taking their time to pick the right candidate.
Josh, I get the feeling that she's been through this before.
Yeah, that's kind of what it felt like.
So I wonder if she kind of has a method to that, because you're right. It seems like a crazy time to ramp up all these new roles if you haven't addressed the culture. But I don't think they can afford to wait. So I'm guessing there'll be like a team dedicated to looking at
maybe a trickle
resumes.
Down. They're hoping for a trickle down culture change.
Yeah,
we'll start at the top.
That'd be crappy to come back into the job.
Oh,
you're finally out. And
she even said, she's like, I'm enjoying my time with my grandchildren, but
here I am.
Time to strap the gun back on.
Yeah, I guess I'll be the one to fix everything again. So we'll keep you posted.
We mentioned in one of our earlier Crime and Updates episodes that there was concern regarding a potential serial killer in Oregon. In early 2023, in a span of less than 3 months, the bodies of 6 women were discovered in isolated, wooded areas near Portland, Oregon. All of the bodies were found within 100 miles of each other, and all of them were under the age of 40. Over the past few months, law enforcement has been rigorously working on this case. We shared with you that they had identified a potential suspect, a man named Jesse Calhoun. We went over it in detail in that episode, but this man has a very long list of criminal activity. It just so happens he was one of several prisoners that had their sentences commuted by former Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Now, a lot of people were pissed by this. The commuted sentences meant some folks got out of prison, and others, like the 17 death row inmates, had their sentences changed from death penalty to life in prison without parole. And maybe later we can dig into our own feelings about that. I have complicated feelings on that matter. But regarding this specific case, when Jesse Calhoun was publicly named a person of interest, his criminal history was quickly uncovered by a variety of media outlets. It was also learned that he had part of his sentence, after serving less than a year, commuted by Oregon's former governor, Kate Brown. In 2019, Calhoun started a 4-year prison sentence for burglary. Then we had the Oregon wildfires, I'm sure some of you remember. Some of us had to prepare to leave our homes, and many Oregonians lost their homes. Well, because they needed people, prisoners with firefighting experience were able to participate in helping to fight the massive wildfires. That then led those with good behavior having their sentences commuted. Calhoun was one of them. It's not surprising some people are blaming the act of changing his sentence for leading to the murder of multiple women. And I'm sure we could sit here and debate that, but we won't. What we will talk about is the fact that Jesse Calhoun, who we told you was the primary person of interest, was finally indicted for murder. On Thursday, May 16th, he was indicted for 3 counts of second-degree murder and 3 counts of second-degree abuse of a corpse in the deaths of Charity Lynn Perry, 24 years old, Bridget Leanne Webster, 31 years old, and Joanna Speaks, 32. 2 additional murdered women have been linked to Jesse Calhoun, 22-year-olds Alicia Real and Kristen Smith. Those cases are still being investigated, and I imagine we may see additional charges against Calhoun at some point, and we will absolutely keep you updated.
Yeah, this was really great news to hear that
there
were finally some charges coming down. And I just want to add that in talking with the family members, every time they've said every time we share the flyer or talk about it, they get at least one tip.
I love that.
Whether or not it's the tip or if it's as helpful as someone thinks, that doesn't matter. One little thing could lead to a million other things.
Yep.
So you can actually contact the family members. You don't have to deal with the police. They are pros at this and know what to do with that information. And you can reach them at unitedjusticegroup.org. The group of United Justice Group, those are family members of the victims. So you are talking to the right people. You can call or text or use a messaging app to reach out at 503-607-8566. You can email them at contactus@unitedjusticegroup.org. Or you can find them on Facebook. Basically, anywhere you see United Justice Group, that's going to be the family members who answer you. And then they can either take the information or redirect you. And I know that that's a relief, but it's a start to things. They know that this is just the beginning.
I went on Coin, I think, last week to talk a little bit about this.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And one of the questions they asked me was this perception of it taking a long time. And I just want to point out, it didn't.
It did not.
This case has gone
much like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah,
I
for
think.
The scope of it, especially.
Exactly. At first, we were a little worried because there were whispers of it being connected, but nobody was announcing that for some time. And they thought, oh, maybe there's multiple people involved. I have been very pleased with the progression of this and how fast they went to indictment. Of course, we're going to have to wait for trial as they build their case. But I just think the perception is like that because it wasn't being shared with the media, which is different for people. We're not seeing updates every week.
Right, right. Yeah, because it's active, it can feel like forever.
Yeah.
But I know they were working and continue, I would assume, to be working very close with the authorities. I honestly feel the speed of things happening, the charges coming, and the coverage is because of those family members.
Oh, they were very involved.
They are some of the most tenacious women I have ever met. They are so kind and loving, but they will take no shit and they are there to figure this out for their loved ones. So I do hope that if the other cases of Ashley and Kristen, if they are connected, that that is figured out and charges come from that. And again, that's where the calling and the tip comes in. And I'm very intrigued to see what they're going to say at the True Crime Fest Northwest.
Yeah.
United Justice Group is going to be giving a presentation. And I personally, I hope it's part of the process of how this all happened.
Yeah. And
I
imagine they can't say too much about the cases.
Itself, yeah.
Nobody wants to ruin. I mean, we look at Seattle. We don't want to be next in line for that.
Exactly.
They need to be diligent about this case. But I am curious about the process. And we have a lot of people who really enjoy hearing that firsthand experience by friends and family, close to victims, what it's like to change laws, you know, file things with the police. We've learned that from talking to Tiffany and Danielle, how
right.
hard that can be. And
well, and then once you hear from families where they're saying, yes, we had to sit and be patient, then, yeah, as observers, we need to sit and be patient. You
right.
know, you can't be bombarding either victim families or the media for things because that could really affect the outcome. So,
and I think TV and media give people an expectation of hearing those details. And with true crime podcasts, where we're talking about solved cases or cold cases, we may have so much more detail than you would ever get in a live case like that. We're just used to it. So you kind of have an expectation when you turn on the news to hear about a serial killer, you're going to get some information about
right.
their motives or
right.
something. We don't know. They're keeping that tight-lipped for a reason.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see if it goes to trial, if he takes a deal, but we'll have updates. I have an update on a couple of the officers who were acquitted for the murder of Manny Ellis. While the courts came to a conclusion of their own, the public heard enough of the case to develop their own opinions. Fun fact, the manslaughter charges faced by the three officers were at the state level. There is an active ongoing investigation on the federal level to find if the men violated Manny's civil rights, and Manny's family has filed a $4 million wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Tacoma. I won't go into the details of Manny's case. We've done it several times, so if you want a refresher, you can visit the full episode of Unknown Trouble on our Patreon or YouTube, or you can listen to more recent update episodes. One of the officers acquitted of the murder of Manny Ellis was Christopher Shane Burbank. Out of a job, he made the move to one of our favorite counties, Thurston. Back to Thurston, Derek Sanders, in all of his wise decision-making, thought that hiring Christopher Burbank was a good idea. He would quickly regret that choice when the public learned of the hiring via a Facebook post. When the public criticized the choice, Sheriff Sanders tried to explain that Burbank would not be an issue because he had completed a 2-month background check. Okay, and in that background check, you found he was charged with manslaughter, but continued with the process. Go on. They also gave Burbank a polygraph. The sheriff explained that overall, the county has been working with mental health co-responders and are using body-worn and dash cameras in an effort to be more transparent. But none of that mattered to the public. So after receiving letters and even death threats, which are never okay, Burbank resigned. This was 2 days after his hiring. Sheriff Sanders released the statement, quote, "When I made the decision to hire Deputy Burbank, I failed to consider the greater community impact and instead made the decision based on business needs to remedy TCSO's staffing crisis. Furthermore, I entirely misjudged the community perception of the investigation and jury process that Deputy Burbank completed. I recognize the harm this has caused to marginalized communities, and I was wrong." He also posted, "Trust is gained in drops and lost in buckets. For those who have lost confidence in me or what we're trying to accomplish at TCSO, I apologize for letting you down." Manny's family, through their attorney, expressed relief at his resignation. They hope it'll keep Thurston safer. Another positive move that will keep everyone safer was the passing of a new law which bars hog tying from being used as a method to detain anyone. The family's lawyer said, "It's obvious that the public still remembers Manny and the horrific things that happened to him. Manny's death was 100% preventable, and the people of Washington know it." Another one of the officers who went to trial for Manny's murder is Timothy Ranke. You may recall Timmy was the only recruit in his 2018 Academy class to, during a virtual test, shoot a suspect in an act that his teacher called completely unjustifiable. 2 months later, he was hired by the Tacoma Police Department. Tim was on the force for less than a year when he was caught on film dragging a suspect down a flight of stairs before being seen kneeling on the man as he handcuffed him. That man, like Manny, cried out, "I can't breathe." Neither Timothy nor the officer involved were disciplined or even investigated after that incident. The victim filed a $500,000 lawsuit, but it has yet to be decided on as the two officers involved are set to go to court for it next year. Just 3 months later, Timmy and the other officers were caught on camera kneeling on and restricting the breathing of Manny Ellis until he died. Now that Tim has been acquitted, he and his wife have filed a $47 million lawsuit against Tacoma and Washington State. More specifically, Tim is suing for $35 million and his wife is seeking $12 million. In the lawsuit, they claim that the charges and the trial alleged that Tim was a racist and had committed criminal misconduct, which has led to threats of death and violence against himself and his wife. He also claims the allegations have made it impossible for him to find work. Let's not forget that the Tacoma Police Department has already spent $1.5 million on paying each officer involved in Manny's death a $500,000 to resign. This was due to the use of force policy that was in place at the time. Basically, according to the Tacoma Police Handbook from when Manny was killed, the men had not used excessive force, but according to the law, they had. James Bible, an Ellis family lawyer, said it best. Ranke could have acted to save Manny Ellis or intervened, but instead he sat on his body in a George Floyd-like fashion. I will keep you updated on any of these lawsuits.
I think I better start my own segment because my quaint little city of Lake Oswego has a lot going on these days. Let's call it LO Crime Beat, shall
we? Ooh, like wet dynamite. I like it.
A couple of updates ago, I shared a story of a real estate mogul in my area who was really inappropriate with a 16-year-old intern at his office. Mm-hmm. I heard another awful story from my city, so of course, I had to share it. And here we are in our first official LO Crime Beat segment.
LO Crime Beat.
The more and more we're online and watching TikTok videos, the more we get to know about the ways different people live their life. I've come across a few videos of people sharing why they don't let their kids have sleepovers. A lot of the time, these parents have experienced abuse and know that a sleepover is a great way to get access to a vulnerable child. Some of them are just very careful. Now, I used to think it was really weird because to me, sleepovers are a staple of childhood. I look back at my own childhood and sleepovers were a fundamental thing for me. Some of my best memories took place at a sleepover. I got to experience the way non-divorced families lived. I got to stay with people whose grandparents raised them. I saw what it was like to have siblings, and I got to eat name brand fancy food. I even got to go camping and on occasional vacations with my friends. When I had my own child, there was no question, sure, she can have a sleepover if I know the parents. Why would I want to deprive my child of the cool things I got to do and see? Oddly enough, my child doesn't like them much. Her preference is to stay at her friend's late and then have me pick her up so she can come home and sleep in her own bed, which I get. So it's less weird for me now when I hear parents say that that's their one big rule. But then this terrifying story came out, and now I think I really get it, and maybe everyone should have this rule. The Maiden family looks like many others in Lake Oswego, a multicultural family living in a nice big house, a family consisting of two parents and two happy children. In August of 2023, the night looked like many others throughout the city. A 12-year-old girl was having friends over for a sleepover. Just before quiet time would commence, the girl's father, Michael Maiden, made some mango smoothies for them. That smoothie would result in a traumatizing night for everyone, and the city would learn that things just aren't always what they seem behind closed doors. Two of the girls fell into a deep sleep after drinking the smoothie. A third girl hadn't finished hers because it tasted weird. Then she noticed her friends were more tired than normal, and she started to feel really weird inside, so she texted her mother, pleading for her to pick her up. Her text read, "Mom, please pick me up and say I had a family emergency. I don't feel safe. I might not respond, but please come get me. Please, please pick me up. Please, please." The girl then texted a family friend when her mom didn't respond. That friend ended up picking her up around 2 a.m. and taking her home. They then woke the girl's parents up, who subsequently began contacting all the other parents. Well, as it turns out, the mango smoothies were packed full of benzodiazepine, which is a depressant that slows the nervous system and makes you super lethargic. It's basically a sedative used for anxiety, reducing seizures, and treating muscle spasms. I was put on these for muscle spasms in college, and I was essentially Sleeping Beauty for a week. They're pretty hardcore. The girls were visibly groggy when speaking to police, and some of them were even blacking out. In the court documents filed, the girls described how Mr. Maiden made them smoothies and was insistent on the girls drinking them. He also came down to the basement to where they were having their spa night slash sleepover several times just to join their conversations. My understanding is most of this information is coming from the girl who didn't finish her smoothie. She wasn't asleep the whole time and was just pretending. The girl described how after drinking her smoothie, she felt woozy, hot, and clumsy. She described Maiden coming down several times to watch them sleep. And at one point, he held his finger under one of the girl's noses and was waving his hand in front of her face as if checking to see if she was asleep.
That just gave me goosebumps on my legs, but in like a sick way.
It's so creepy. And then it's, I don't know why, but this part made it even more creepy for me. Apparently, he gave them each a different colored reusable straw and cup so that they could tell whose smoothie was whose and that they wouldn't drink their own. But like in my head, I'm picturing that's how he could keep it straight, which one and, drank
or
the
not
most.
Overdose one of them
right.
or something. Oh,
I don't know why, just that like final touch of after him watching them.
It's the thought of detail.
Yeah.
It's that he isn't just, oh, I'll see what happens. It's I have a plan.
The ways in which he's considerate are revolting.
I agree. And then I'm like thinking about the motive, like, is it just so they're quiet? Or, I mean, obviously that's not what I think the case was, but it's just so, I can picture it in a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
All of the girls were eventually picked up by either their own family or one of the other families. And one girl was taken directly to the hospital because she couldn't even walk without help. That's how they discovered what had been in their drinks. Michael Maiden turned himself into police after all of this and was arrested in March, months after the event. He was eventually released on $50,000 bail, which was much to the dismay of the families. Since then, his wife filed for divorce and has full custody of both children. This past March, Michael Maiden was hospitalized after overdosing on lorazepam, which he tried to use to take his own life. The families see this as a threat to their children. They believe that he's a man who is desperate, and desperate people may do something against their better logic, and they're worried he might come after them. The families then came together and petitioned the court to require GPS monitoring on Maiden to ensure their safety. A judge agreed with this, and on May 13th, Maiden, who is now living in Washington State, is required to be monitored. He's currently in counseling and is trying to work out some kind of relationship with his now ex-wife and children. He has been charged with 3 felony counts for causing another person to ingest a controlled substance, 3 felony accounts for applying a Schedule 4 controlled substance to a minor, and 3 misdemeanor counts of delivering a Schedule 4 controlled substance to a minor. He pleaded not guilty, and hopefully we'll know more soon as he goes back into court.
And so what was the time difference of it
months? It happened in the summer, like August, I think I said.
Gosh.
Yeah, so I don't know what that means. Like, I imagine the parents press charges.
Thorough of an investigation?
I couldn't find any info.
Because in my mind,
if
your child is in the hospital and they are tested and they find out that they're on these major sedatives.
Well, and I know they press charges.
That would have then immediately it's CPS and it's immediate, like all these things. So that's very strange. I would assume, or I guess I would hope that was coming from investigating.
I think it was. And they also, obviously, there was the divorce and they probably did investigate with his own daughter. And I don't know if it's a boy or girl, other child, but it's so
foul.
Creepy. It's awful. And the pictures of this guy. Oh, boy, you guys.
Oh, wait. OK, hold on.
Blog.
What's his name?
Michael. And then his last name is Meyden. And I have great pictures for the blog.
Go. I guess we go.
There's a great one of him in a kimono or something.
I just don't even want to think about what his goal was.
I know. I am so thankful that girl. So she said that the smoothie had little white chunks on the top, like he couldn't even bother grinding it up properly.
So it's bitter.
So thank God, though, she tasted that. And maybe she's a super taster. Maybe she tastes the bitter like I do.
And he was probably so horny.
He was so gross while giving it to them, like it was ice cream sundae.
He couldn't focus on accuracy. Like everyone, they just want to do the thing.
It's so gross. That made me so skeeved out just now.
Ugh. Like they're all asleep and you're just coming down to watch that. Is it the control of
Well, and here's the other thing, you guys.
Was he going to do other things?
My big question is, has he done it before? Like, has he been successful? Like, does he do this to his own child on the regular basis?
Ugh.
Because it doesn't seem like this is a first time.
Right. Yeah. He wasn't like, I don't know. We'll see.
His age alone makes it more likely.
So that's what makes me think.
I would love to know the age difference with the wife.
I think that's probably why it took so long. I'm guessing they're building a pretty robust case.
Oh, yeah. Finding out where he got the drugs.
And I mean, the little girl was away from him because of the divorce and the mom getting custody. Thank God. But I shudder to think about what his motive was and what he had intended and what he has done before.
Please let that photo of him in the Japanese stuff get entered into evidence.
Oh, yes.
Let the jury see it.
Bring it in on a canvas. As a parent, if your child is staying at someone else's house, wouldn't you go out of your way to have your phone make noise?
Actually, you bring up a very good point, and I think
because my instinct is like, excuse you?
We're going to leave this in because I want to talk about this. So there are a couple things that I have learned from this or have thought about over time. My daughter, like I said, prefers to not have sleepovers. She has had a few. There are a couple of people she's very comfortable with that she will do that. But she has called and asked me in the middle of the night to pick her up. So, yes, I turn my ringer on when she is anywhere but with me.
Right.
And I would hope that at least one of my very close friends, in which my daughter has their phone number in an emergency, would have theirs on in the middle of the night. So that's something to say to people. Like, I know we all kind of go on do not disturb when we go to sleep, but it's really important sometimes to have that on for these types of scenarios.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's why you have a landline.
Like, what if Chloe called you? Quiet it. What if Chloe called you in the middle of the night because of a situation like this and you didn't answer?
Right. That would feel horrible.
It would feel horrible.
If I saw, I missed her call at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So that, it's something that's to keep in mind.
I mean, I know I'm not a parent, but that just really struck me and how awful that would feel for kids. Here we are in this day and age of we're supposed to be in contact 24/7.
And we pat people on the back for having open communication. No, I get it. And it's hard sometimes because you don't want to envision a scenario like that happening. But we have an obligation, I think. Well, I think most parents probably do. Leave their phone on when their kid isn't home. But it's just an extra reminder of like, this could have been so much worse.
Yeah.
Also, another thing I think is important to call out is we should really be talking openly that it is okay to not eat or drink something someone gives you.
Yes.
There are so many times where I've been like, okay, I need to be polite and finish my plate and I might not like it or my. It's okay to not finish it. So I think it's good to encourage kids to, I know we all say that like clear your plate and you can go play. But I think this is one of those reasons. If it tastes funny, don't eat it.
Yeah.
Don't
or maybe
be
they're
polite.
A picky eater and you're just like sending them into an anxiety spiral and they're not going to have fun because you're forcing them to eat a carrot, Cheryl.
I mean,
that might be a little personal, but
that
just
sounds a little personal. I'm just saying it makes sense. Like if you're going into if you go into a really dirty house or there's pet hair everywhere, I'm unlikely to eat a cookie
right,
baked by that person. That's okay.
You'd better eat our cookies if we make cookies. We have dogs everywhere. How dare you?
Talking about our
that
house,
felt pointed.
Our stinky dog house.
I need to call some sort of arbitrator for this.
No, this is actually a specific scenario from my childhood. My mom wouldn't let me eat baked goods from a certain neighbor who was a hoarder. And that's why.
Yeah.
So
I remember hearing about
just her. A couple of things to think about.
I'm seeing a lot more conversations around slumber parties in general of you don't have to stay there. You're not stuck at that house if you are uncomfortable for any reason. Do you have a tummy ache? Are your friends being weird? Is the recliner you're sleeping in uncomfortable?
Yep.
You know that you don't have to do that, and I think that's important too, because I never thought of calling, but there were times where I was like, I don't want to be stuck here, or I don't want to watch a scary movie, or they're kind of being whatever, I want to go home, but it didn't ever cross my mind as an option.
I called my mom before to pick me up in an uncomfortable, not a dangerous situation,
right.
Just an uncomfortable situation, and I was lucky she was able to pick me up, because there are a lot of times my mom would have been like, hell no.
I'm at work. No.
Suck it up. Go to bed. I am very thankful for the community that I live in for a couple of things, one of which is the moms stay in pretty tight contact and Chloe's groups of friends. Like, we know when something's up. There was a situation a few years back where there was some bullying happening. Somebody
I remember
remember? And the moms kind of, we band together.
Yeah.
We went to the school and addressed it. And that was nice. It's nice to know they have your back. And I do not doubt for a second that if I didn't answer my phone in the middle of the night, one of her friend's moms would pick her up for me. So there is that. That's nice. But it's just kind of a reminder of how things can be totally behind the scenes different than what you expect. They could be a nice couple and you've met them before and that happens. Yikes.
Yeah. I liked all my 90s friends' dads. They barely ever spoke to us and just stayed in their room. They're like, oh, slumber party. See you later. We're going to head now to Yakima, Washington. I want to start by warning that this is related to animals. I know we talk about murders, but I get it. It's a different emotion when animals are involved. So just skip ahead a few minutes if you don't want to hear this. Heartwood Haven is an animal sanctuary in Washington, and I learned of this story from their Instagram. You should follow them if you love seeing adorable animals and you want to donate to help the many animals they care for. You can find them at Heartwood Haven. This story starts on April 18th in Yakima. A federal investigation led authorities to a home in eastern Washington. When the dust settled from the raid, 34 people were facing charges related to money laundering, guns, drugs, attempted murder of a witness, and cockfighting. On a map, Yakima and Roy, Washington are only about 60 miles apart. However, due to the terrain, it's a nearly four-hour drive. When authorities realized that they would need assistance with the dozens of birds, they reached out to the Heartwood Haven Sanctuary. Without hesitation, the team from Heartwood started the process of helping the 150 roosters and hens that had been rescued from the home, making this the largest rescue of cockfighting birds in Washington State's history. As Kate Zerkelvich from Heartwood told K5 News, most people are not aware cockfighting even exists. It's happening all the time. It's a huge industry and is very prevalent across the whole state. For those unaware of the horrible practices of cockfighting, it is literally that. Like dogfighting, roosters are trained to fight other roosters. When it comes to an actual fight, literal razor-sharp knives are attached to their feet and they violently kill their opponent. There is a shockingly large market still involved in this barbaric practice. With so many birds in need, Heartwood reached out to their social media followers asking for help, be it in the form of a home for the rescued roosters or donations to help care for them in the interim. Donations and offers came pouring in from across the country, and before long, the dozens of birds had places to go. Everything was set. Homes were in place, carriers were stacked. Heartwood took the first few weeks preparing to care for the birds and to get them safely to their new homes. Their first batch, which I'm not quite sure on all of this, but it seems that the first batch of birds maybe were about 100, they all made it safely to rescue and were on their way to their beautiful new life. Then the ATF called the sanctuary. They had bad news. The remaining birds, it's believed to be about 64 of them, had all been euthanized. This was shocking news. The birds were cleared to come to the sanctuary. They had room and would eventually have homes. How could this have happened? In a baffling and unexplainable move, Yakima County Sheriff's Office took it upon themselves to go into the holding area of the 64 birds and, with a shotgun, shoot each bird individually.
Oy.
Which must have been some of the most horrifying moments imaginable for those roosters. When local media outlets learned of what had transpired, they were able to get documents from the sheriff's office. It was clearly written in the documentation that the SO was aware they were actively working with the sanctuary to rehome the birds. There is no denying the investigators working on the case were aware of the process that was taking place, that the birds were going to be rehomed and the shelter was merely waiting for the go-ahead to go pick them up and to get them to their new safe placements. Roosters used in cockfighting have long been perceived as vicious and aggressive animals. In reality, they aren't. Okay, I mean, they're still roosters, but like the stigma surrounding pit bulls, the birds are only violent because they're forced to be. This positive shift in perspective has allowed for more roosters to be rescued instead of euthanized. In the past, when euthanasia has been deemed appropriate, it was done humanely, via a shot like at a vet, not a shotgun like at a shooting range. One of the documents claimed the shooting of the birds was due to a time constraint. But in looking at the timeline, there was a six-hour window. And again, I'm not positive on how all of this transpired, but it looked like that morning when they were starting to make the plan, and they could have then called Kate, and she would have been there in 3 hours. And if she had received that call, she would have found a way to save every single bird. But in that 6 hour window, no call was ever made to the sanctuary. So from the start of the day until 6 hours later, no call happens, and then they kill all the birds. In response to the public outcry regarding their decision, the Yakima County Sheriff's Office released the following statement. We could not leave the roosters at the home since owning, possessing, or housing cockfighting roosters is illegal in Washington State. If we had left, the owner would have moved them, so we couldn't have found them. That doesn't exactly clear up why a call to the shelter wasn't made or why the euthanasia was not done humanely. If you would like to help Heartwood Haven continue their work in saving as many animals as they can, you can donate at heartwoodhaven.org. There, you can also learn about the animals and all of the work they do. And I highly suggest following them on socials as well, because who doesn't love to see little piggies on their phone? So that's the story of the roosters in Yakima.
That's really sad.
It's very sad, and it's very frustrating that they're like, well, we couldn't have left the birds. Right. So why did you wait 6 hours instead of only waiting three if you called her right
Especially
away?
Especially if they had someone saying they could find placements.
It was set. It was in the paperwork.
That's so weird.
So we'll see.
Oregon's Gardner-Reedsport Winchester Bay Salmon Trout Enhancement Programs began in 1982. Its Umpqua Step Hatchery is located in coastal Reedsport. You guys been to Reedsport? Beautiful, gloomy, wet.
Perfect.
The hatchery captures fall Chinook salmon for breeding, artificially spawns them, and raises the eggs to produce a goal of 100,000 pre-smolt and 70,000 smolt for release into the Umpqua River estuary. Smolting, for those that don't know, is a physiological pre-adaptation that salmon go through so that they'll be able to swim in seawater. So the baby fishies go through a change in their appearance where they become silvery, and they start swimming with the current instead of against it.
Mm.
It's just to prepare them for life as an adult, a short, weird life of a salmon. Earth Day 2024 was on April 22nd, and on that day, the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, where Reedsport is, received a call about a break-in at the hatchery, which is operated by that STEP program that I talked about. This call was made after a worker going out to feed the fishes discovered the 18,000 pre-smolt salmon dead in their rearing tanks. The following day, around 6:30 p.m., a Douglas County Sheriff's Office deputy patrolling the area spotted a man in the hatchery behind the locked gate and a no trespassing sign. Did not work there, should not have been there. The man, identified as 20-year-old Joshua Heckathorn, was questioned at the scene and admitted to trespassing on the property and entering a storage location and handling the chemical bottle.
Oh, no.
The chemical bottle was a gallon of bleach, which he emptied into those tanks.
Sick.
Yes.
Do we know how much time and money goes into that, to those 18,000?
Oh, I didn't see, but it was, I believe it was a quarter of the entire population.
Jesus.
Somewhere around there. I think they're going for 100,000, and this is almost 20.
It's so calculated.
I guess it's 18% is what it is.
It's calculated so scientifically to make sure the population of fish that they're putting out there, there's a calculation in order to ensure that the population is,
it's not overpopulated,
healthy as
healthy
it can be.
Yep.
Yikes.
The president of STEP said the deaths constituted a quarter of the hatchery's pre-smolts. So not all of them, but all of the pre-smolts.
So it could have been worse, but it's pretty bad.
Very bad. STEP president Deborah Yates said, "When someone comes in and does something like this, you can't wrap your head around it. We have so many hours wrapped up in those fish. To have someone come in so cavalier and kill them, it doesn't make sense. Ironically, it was Earth Day. We were highly concerned that it was eco-terrorists." And it was, but I don't think with any sort of...
Not a group.
A code or anything.
Yeah, no. I think in a terrorist group, it has to be multiple people with an intent to do that. Well, I guess he had intent.
This guy's more of an asshole.
I'm getting the same feelings of those one-offs that try to break into electrical systems. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that's called, like power
grid.
Yeah.
Didn't I talk about one of those recently?
Yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm.
Oregon State Police Sergeant Levi Harris said, "The killing of these fish is a real blow to the STEP program volunteers, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, fishermen, and the community as a whole. And the STEP hatchery is a volunteer-only facility."
And not to mention, think of the impact, the long-term impact of the people that require those fish to live. You know, the fishing supports more than just people buying it in the store.
Yeah.
There are tribes that rely
on just the ecosystem alone.
Yeah.
You know, what they eat, is that going to be overpopulated because there's not enough salmon?
It's like, did this person think that through, or they think it was funny, or they have, like, what was their intent?
No motive yet. He said nothing. He admitted to it immediately, but hasn't given any reasons as to why.
Jesus.
And it happened on Earth Day. That would be very strange if that was a coincidence.
Yeah.
And from OPB, the level of damage done to the hatchery's young Chinook population has elevated the case to one of poaching, making it a matter for the Oregon State Police's Division of Fish and Wildlife to investigate. Local Joshua Heckathorn was lodged at the Douglas County Jail and has since been released. He had a court appearance on May 16th, but that was delayed until the 20th because of some sort of transportation issue. Penalties might include a lifetime angling license suspension and damage suits for the unlawful killing of wildlife. Step further said that the maximum civil penalty in Oregon for illegal take of a single Chinook salmon is $750. But courts have the authority to multiply that amount by the number of fish taken.
Hell yeah.
That means the amount could potentially increase to more than $13 million, although it is unlikely to elevate to that level. Joshua Heckathorn had a court date on the 16th, They delayed it to the 20th, and on the 20th, he did not show up for court. So there's now a bench warrant for his arrest. Let me. I think there was a quote. Well, the judge said there's now a warrant that's been issued, and we'll see if we can help Mr. Heckathorn find his way to court.
We'll guide him. We'll hold his hand.
If you would like to learn about the Step Hatchery or support their all-volunteer staff, go to umpquastephatchery.org. And Umpqua is U-M-P-Q-U-A.
I'm more than anything just fascinated as to why. Was he bored and wanted to see what would happen?
Did he hold some sort of grudge against them?
Yeah, or is it an animal thing where
he's scared of salmon?
That's his way of killing animals.
And he's so young. Impressionable. He seems like he'd be quite impressionable. Weren't we all?
20 years old. Hey, I'm going to just like never make a dime because it will all go back to paying for these fish and I'll be in jail a long time because I didn't go to court. Well, we've got a real theme going on today because I have another animal related thing to talk about, but it's not animal deaths. So everyone's in the clear. I'm sure many of you saw a few weeks ago a question being posed on the internet. And the question was,
oh, yes,
ladies, if you are walking alone in the woods, would you rather encounter a bear or a man you do not know? So I actually went on a walk the other day and I ended up in our little wooded area. It's not like a full forest, but it's the woods. And I was kind of thinking my whole way there about that question because, one, I hate wearing bras the size of my chest. It really hurts my neck and back, so I'd rather walk without. We've covered enough stories now to know people have been stalked or harmed or killed for less. And then there I go into the woods and I'm safe. I have my headphones off. I'm armed in a way, giving it the thought. And I was just like, yeah, in the woods where just a few months ago the police were called because some dude had a knife that he held at a 13-year-old girl. I think I'm going with the bear. And I would love to hear both y'all's thoughts on that question, especially Josh from a male perspective. But you'll have to wait because I want to hear Emily first.
I'm absolutely a bear. It is unlikely I'm going to get attacked by a bear if I leave it alone, but can't say the same about a man. Right. Sorry. I'm not a man hater, but there's just too many bad things that we talk about that I'm not going to trust a stranger in the woods. Yeah. Bear isn't carrying hidden weapons. A bear doesn't have a history of abuse.
A bear is not going to do other things besides kill you. And a bear, there's reason for it.
Yeah.
You're invading its territory.
There are worse things than death.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, if I get mauled, I could even survive. A bear isn't going to keep me in a box for years. A bear isn't going to rape me. A bear isn't going to keep a part of my body as a trophy. The list goes on and on. And the scariest moment of my life was encountering a strange man in the woods. He didn't do anything, but I don't know that seeing a bear would be more scary than that moment.
Bears are supposed to be there.
Yeah.
So I'm going with bear.
Yeah.
If I had that happen to me, what happened to you, seeing that scary man in the middle of the night in Forest Park, mm-hmm. is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I might have died. That would scare me so badly. Yeah, I would go with bear. I don't want to fight either. And I would rather fight a man, like hurt one.
Yeah, physically.
But
it's more doable. But
a bear, I feel like I might be able to talk down. I've watched The Edge a lot. Actually, you know what? Yeah, bear for that reason as well.
And I'm curious from your perspective, Josh, do you see the point of the question? I know it became a hot button topic on the interwebs because many men were coming to the defense of men to say, well, not all men. And
that's not the point.
And also, it's not the point.
Also not all bears.
Right.
Winnie, Smokey, Bart.
But not all men is not a good argument because, yeah, of course not all men.
Just mostly men do it.
But I'm not taking the chance of the man that you put in the woods with me,
right.
That the statistics are going to work out in my favor.
That's like saying, here's a bucket of apples. Only one of them is full of poison.
Yeah.
Well, okay, not all the apples, but
Russian
I'm not going to fuck with an apple.
Yeah. So I see their point, and but that has nothing to do with why women are choosing bear, really.
And it also becomes about that debate instead of, well, isn't that messed up that that's how people feel? That should be the conversation. Well, how do we make it to where men aren't being perceived as the bears? The men aren't talking to each other about that. They're yelling at the women of, well, no, I'm not. It's like, well, no, that's not helping. So I loved the conversation that came from it. And I hope that more things like that keep happening so that those feelings can be understood, that it's not a judgment. It's not a, I hate men. It's not a, that it's, I'm just trying to be safe, man. I'm just trying to walk in the woods. Shit. Well, let's end with some good news, shall we, Josh? We have often talked about how we would react if we saw something happen, or how frustrated we get when we hear these stories of people not stopping to help situations or to check things out. And I would like to report that while those scenarios are just made up, so we don't know how we would really react, Josh here, he will not let things happen without stopping to check it out. Josh?
Last week, I drove to the market around the corner, and as I was coming back down our street, back into our neighborhood, I saw our diagonally across the street neighbor who was working on his fence. He has a wooden kind of ponderosa style fence that he was putting up, I think. And when I was driving back through, I saw that he was laying on his lawn looking up, and he kind of had one of his legs cocked up. So it looks like he was just kind of lounging on the sloped lawn. And I was like, that's weird. He's not moving and he's holding a drill. And so I parked the car and I walked inside and I was like, Leash, come out here. And we looked and he was not moving at all. And so we rushed over there. And I think Leash, you knew that he was diabetic, right?
Yeah. So everyone in the neighborhood knows about Bob, because every couple of years the ambulance shows up. And I learned when I was younger, oh, that's Bob. He's got extreme diabetes. And so when Josh came up, he's like, hey, can you come with me to go check on this guy and see what's going on? I'm like, oh, yeah. Do you have your cell phone with you? Because I'm like, this is probably what's happening. And he did. So we walked over. And I was calling out to him before we got there, and he wasn't acknowledging. And then we got up close to him, and I could see his eyes were shiny and glossy and kind of going all over the place. He was not coherent. So I told Josh, and he was an excellent co-crisis person. I was like, I need you to call 911, tell him where we are, what's going on. He got right on top of it. For like your first 911 call?
I think I might have called once before when I was trying to stop an altercation in Northwest Portland once.
Oh, that sounds
maybe
about right.
But no, I've never had that sort of emergency happen near me or anything like
and
that.
And you did great. You kept your cool. You were doing everything that needed to happen. I was trying to get Bob to wake up enough. He kind of sat up and came to, and hey, what's your name? Oh, Bob. Oh, who's in the house? It took several minutes to find out who was in the house. Josh went and got the wife, and it was so funny, like old news to her. I know he's been having issues for a long time, but he is much older now, so she maybe shouldn't have been so casual about it. She's like, oh, I'll get my shoes. Bob, get up. I'll get my shoes. I'll be right out. So she eventually comes out, and the ambulance shows up, but I finally got the drill out of his hands. He had like a death grip on it, and he was going in and out of consciousness.
He looked like he was dead several times.
There were two times. There was once he had a really heavy breath, and I was like, eater. And then another time he went, oh, Christ.
Oh, dear.
Oh, were those his last? Do I have to tell his wife his last words were, oh, Christ? Anyway, so the ambulance showed up, medics, everybody, they took care of him. And again, his wife was like, oh, they know. It's just Bob. They know him. It's fine. And he kept saying, oh, I thought I ate enough. I thought I did. But it was the first real hot day, like, you know, a week or so ago when it was like, whoa, summer's here. So he went out. He's an elderly man. He was taking down his little decorative fence, and I think the heat just got him and his diabetes got him. But he was okay. I was out mowing later that evening, and I saw this figure coming toward me, and I couldn't really tell who it was, and I took my glasses off. I was like, Bob? It's only been a few hours.
He was fine. He's wearing the same clothes.
Yeah. He was like, hey, is Josh here? I'm like, yeah. So I went and grabbed Josh.
He just wanted to shake my hand and say thank you for the help. And he was lovely. It was great to meet a neighbor. And it was...
That's how you met your neighbor?
That's what yeah. I said. I said, oh, it was really nice to actually do something neighborly. I thought that was really funny. A funny aside from that, it was great. I've never had an experience like that. It felt good to have been able to be an active participant in that and to help, I guess. You know, like I didn't know that I was... that I would do that or could do that.
And you did it.
But when Bob was standing in front of me to thank me and explain kind of what had happened, he had been eating something just before that and he wasn't done with it. And so when he was talking to me, there were like little flecks of food coming out of his mouth, like onto his lips. And I was like, oh, there's ham. That's bread. And so I was trying to talk to him, but I was screaming inside.
Wow.
So if I save you,
don't talk.
I'll notice the things. I was like hyper focused. I was like, oh my God, there's this bread flying out of his mouth. And there goes some. Well, anyways.
Well, I'm proud of you for checking in to say, hey, that wasn't right. And for how well you handled crisis.
Thank you.
I felt pretty chill. And we came home and he's like, my hands are cold. I'm like, you've had a lot of adrenaline.
Yeah, I think I kind of was like, in shock.
I was like, you're going to be tired, like so tired in about an hour and you're going to need to lay down. OK.
And I did. I had to and I did.
I lucked out when I had to call 911 last year. At some point, I saw a really terrible scooter crash.
Oh yeah.
I remember. And I was thankful that it was at night because I was so tired. I just went home and went to bed.
Yeah.
You know, I handled it pretty well, too, but I found it really hard to tell north, south, east and west when I was describing where we were. I'm like, going this way down this road.
Yeah.
I am proud of you. That's good to notice that. Some people wouldn't even look.
Yeah. In that moment, that might feel so surreal that if you don't have someone with you, then it's you. Your brain can't say, oh, maybe that was just a raccoon or maybe it was a college prank or, you know, so just it's better to check than to assume.
Yeah, I don't want that body on my conscience.
Or my front yard.
And Steve S. from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Whoop. From where? That sounds exotic.
Pennsylvania.
Shut your face.
Do they have Draculas there?
Quiet. I make one mistake in 17 weeks.
We also have other level.
Oh, my God.
Oh, shit. In Denver?
Yeah.
Fuck. Don't forget the yogurt.
It's a smooth weekday recording if I ever heard one.
Middle of the day, middle of the week. Hello.
Then we had the Oregon wildfires. Some of us had to prepare to leave our homes, and many Oregons.
My Oregons.
But it has yet to be done. Wipe out. Wife has my tongue feels like the size of a lobster tail.
It is. I've been meaning to tell you.
For what?
For licking booths.
Your bunghole.
Who needs a kissing booth when you can have a licking booth?
These sweet little nips.
To require GPS monitoring. Mm. Whoops, let me say that again. So the families came together and potentially.
Let me try that again.
Say it again. Hartwood,
my favorite parish.
Hartwood Haven is an animal. Oh boy, my mouth is. She's so tired.
Chinook me all night long.
I will. It is under duress. I don't really want to. I wish.
Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, I do. I feel like everyone in this neighborhood should have a little ponderosa fence.
I love the ponderosa.
It's very
fence.
Cute.
I want a
They're
hedge
just so,
wall.
They don't do anything.
No,
though.
No, they look like they could hold a little donkey, and maybe that's why I like them.
Oh, would a little donkey eat our grass? I can't relate either, but if our dog, Rosie, called us at 2 a.m., I'd be real concerned. In this scenario, you just see it. You're not, you don't know what's going to happen. You're just
right.
Like,
would you basically, would you rather be walking on a trail and an encounter?
Oh, a bear. Either. Yeah, I see. Yeah. Not actually. I was thinking of actually, of course, fighting it.
Actually, I'm pretty sure I could fight a bear.
No, I don't
and
think
a tiger.
I don't think
and
so.
And a lion at the same time.
I think I could fight a man.
Yes.
A short king.
With weak arms and little legs.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for engaging in that discussion, everybody. I
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
I'm sorry that it is that way.
Thank you.
For everyone. I'm not apologizing for men. I'm just, that's poopy for you.
Thank you.
That's a bug. That's you guys, it starts and then it never stops. All of the shit. Health, whatever. Every scenario is a possible murder about to happen. Oh, I went in for a job interview and I was killed. Oh, I went to Arby's, killed. I looked at a man in the grocery store. We don't know where I am.
Yeah.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as a dollar a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain.
And suck my balls.